Chinese menu in his hand. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the view of Wolfpack Research or any of its officers. The views and opinions expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on this program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. We are not investment advisors. We hold no registrations with the SEC, FINRA, or any other regulatory agency, and none of the opinions expressed on this podcast should be considered investment advice. Listeners should assume that we have positions in and stand to benefit from any stock or other security mentioned on this podcast. Do your own research before making investment decisions.
Welcome to the Wolf Den, everybody. This is Dan David coming at you back with the pack. And by pack, I mean Carl the Sound Guy, though he loves to be called Sound Carl for any of his fans. On top of that, we also have, back by popular demand, Tick the Editor Guy, who will say nothing. He will sit in the background and not speak. Right, Tick? Exactly. He just threw me an okay sign.
He's sitting in the bathroom with Jojo the Whale.
Oh, what is that? Your what reference to?
Goodfellas, wasn't it?
No, that's not Goodfellas. That is Bronx Tale.
Bronx Tale. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So we have a special guest this week. Not only can our special guest school Carl on why his frozen pizza costs more, and he used to set the rules for the government and what we do when it comes to cost. Joseph Lavorgna. Joe is a Wall Street economist who served as the chief economist of the National Economic Council and special assistant to the president. My old job. Welcome, Joe. We have a lot to talk about. I'm sure we have a lot in common, other than you're an economist and I am not. Where do we start? I mean, we've got a war in Europe, rising inflation costs that are not transitory, in my opinion. Maybe you can tell me whether they are or they aren't. The effect of sanctions and whether that matters. Do we have a recession coming? And China, where we stand in the next coming years where it comes to China, our debt, their debt.
Dan, thank you for having me. Let me just start. I feel like those are a lot of pointed, detailed questions. I feel trapped. So I could sort of maybe give you a movie line related to the movie you just mentioned earlier. Now use can't leave.
That's fantastic.
Now I can't leave. I need to answer those questions. So where do we start? Here's what I would say, just to give you a little bit of backdrop to sort of set the table. The economy last year did very well. That was my view. That was some other people's views as well. The V-shaped recovery began in 2020. Many didn't think it would happen. It occurred then. It carried over into 2021. We got a lot of extra government stimulus, almost certainly unnecessary, but we had it. Fueled demand, which was already rebounding, partly because of the pent-up demand, people were locked in, partly because of the stimulus that we were giving. And also we had a reopening story where people had the opportunity to transact. So the economy grew very, very strongly, almost 6%. That was the best year since 1984. But at the time, as much as I was upbeat on 2021 for growth, for GDP, I was concerned about where we would be in 2022, because historically, when you have a really good performance in the economy of 6% or better, the following year growth tends to fall by half. But I also observed that most of the growth was occurring in the consumer side. And I thought of it as a pull forward. And the reason that matters is the inflation initially was demand driven, then it became supply driven. And what we're seeing now, Dan, is really a persistence of supply driven inflation, where now, importantly, you're seeing higher food and energy costs occur in part because of what's happened in Europe with some supply chain disruptions. The fact that Ukraine exports roughly, I believe, a quarter of the world's wheat. Clearly, Russia is a big energy producer. We're not importing oil from Russia. So that's helped push energy and oil prices specifically higher. So you've got this situation where the economy was good. It's weakening now. Inflation's high. Is it transitory? I don't know. It depends how you define transitory. I mean, if we look after the Second World War, we had inflation around 1% or 2% and went to 20, and then it came down quite significantly. And around, I think, late 47, early 48, inflation was like around 1. So was that transitory? I don't know, 3 years. So it's a really difficult backdrop. It makes it very difficult for investing. So it's very complicated. Any economist right now who tells you they know what's going to happen is lying to you or themselves, because there's no real playbook for what we're going through at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, when you go back to post-World War II and you say that, I don't think, by the way, to answer your question, 3 years is transitory in the sense that we first started hearing that term come out of the White House. I think 3 years of persistent inflation, if it gets up to double digits, would be really bad. But when you talk post-World War II, it got up to 20 and then back down to 1. Well, it was back down to 1 after it was at 20, right? So,
yeah, right. No, that's exactly right. This isn't a good development by any means. But again, this is the problem when the Fed tries to be transparent and the wordsmithing of what does transitory mean. I mean, everything is truly relative. I think the market believed that transitory was going to be measured in terms of months or maybe quarters.
Right.
You step far enough back from history, you're right. I mean, 3 years isn't very much over a century, but certainly nobody would think that's transitory. But we're doing things, unfortunately, right now, Dan, that exacerbate the inflation problem. And what really worries me, and I think this is what's interesting, is the Fed needs to respond to it. They're going to be tightening rates into a weak economy. And therefore, what that means is recession risk is very high.
Yeah.
And I think investors might be underestimating those risks.
Well, Carl wanted to bring this line up himself because he told me before, I think it's kind of funny and not necessarily pointed at you, but what were you saying about
the economist joke is the economists have predicted 30 of the last 5 recessions.
Or 300 of the last 5 recessions. Although I think this one might be the one. And recessions are not always bad.
Economists don't really predict any recessions, believe it or not. What Carl is referring to is the equity market has predicted. I believe it was, quote came from Paul Samuelson, and it was something like the equity markets predicted like 11 of the past 5 recessions, something like that. Economists haven't predicted any recession historically. In fact, oftentimes we're in recessions and the vast majority of economists, the overwhelming consensus, doesn't see it. And that partly reflects just the fact the economy is incredibly complex. I mean, you're looking at GDP that's over $20 trillion. And then that's just final goods and services. So if you measure the economy with the intermediate sector, the things that aren't measured as final goods and services, the economy really, Dan, is closer to like $40 trillion in size.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to predict these things. There's a lot of complexity. And that's why I said earlier, you have to be very careful in terms of the outlook, because you know, we've never had a situation where you've had, effectively as a land war in Europe. At the same time, you've got soaring food and energy costs. At the same time, the Fed hasn't raised interest rates. Monetary policy looks really easy, meaning money is cheap. However, when you look at the investment space, you look at the yield curve, the treasury yield curve, which is the difference between long and short rates, which has a great record predicting recessions, it says we're going to get a recession. So this is what I was saying. We have to be very humble in our approach and realize we don't really know what's going to happen, in part because the variables we're trying to guess themselves are so uncertain. The assumptions, underlying inputs are so uncertain.
Well, you have to have recessions. I mean, and I'm not just saying that because I'm an activist short seller. I mean,
full disclosure.
Yeah, full disclosure. Right. Yeah, I do have a day job. But you have to have some sense of reality. And I mean, it's mostly CNN predicting recessions and of that ilk. But, you know, there's credit bubbles that need to be looked at. I don't necessarily think we have a housing bubble, though housing prices are going up on low supply. That's starting to tick up. You know, I worry about this inflationary period along with historic debt and raising interest rates, because I mean, look, when we raise interest rates, don't we owe more on our national debt at $30 trillion? I mean, if we're looking at 2% or 3% debt service there, what does that come out to? $900 billion a year?
Yeah, no, that's we still own the majority of our debt.
Correct.
That interest is going to ourselves. Our ability to finance it is where it's basically the difference between the cost of debt, what our effective average weighted maturity or average weighted interest rate is, relative to nominal growth. So you could have high debt. The question is, you know, financing it. The problem I see, though, with the debt largely has been the Fed has kept rates too low for too long. That has encouraged companies to financially engineer their earnings.
Yes.
Buy back stock, issue cheap debt, roll over debt. And what we learned from the 2008-2009 crisis is that debt financing, while it might be more stable in some sense than equity financing, when the debt goes away, you get real big problems with balance sheets and the downturns tend to be deeper. I would much rather, Dan, see companies invest in people and in business. And this is going to go into the realm of, well, how do you do that? What's the government's role in sort of incentivizing businesses to do these things? I just don't see at the moment the incentive for this to happen. And the Fed has clearly been a factor also disincentivizing business. We've had easy money for too long, which has caused the debt to occur. The problem then becomes is sort of the tail wags the dog because debt becomes so large that you're right. If you raise rates and your borrowing costs go up, that could be one of the biggest, fastest line items on fiscal expenditures, which ironically was the case back in the early 90s, which led President Bush at the time to break his no new tax pledge, if you remember. It was, well, the bond vigilantes want lower rates, but if we do it, we have to raise taxes so as to get the budget under control. And that's when debt was, I'm going to guess, maybe at the time, instead of 30 trillion, probably around 10. I'm going to guess.
Also, we had a war and he decided we should pay for it rather than like charge it on the credit card. And then that came with some tax increases too. But you know, you brought up that we owe ourselves. And this is something like a lot of listeners don't understand. And a lot of just mainstream investors are like, oh, we just won't pay back China. They own very, very little of our debt. What, 2%? It's you know, unfunded pensions, liabilities, the treasury that we owe ourselves, right? So there's no sense that there's not paying back the debt because who we're not paying back is ourselves.
That's right. I mean, but the problem is there is good debt and there's bad debt. If, like, for example, most, maybe this is not the great example. It was a better example maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago. But you went to school or you went to graduate school to invest in your human capital to get higher wages. And that was perceived to be an investment. So you took on debt to go to school to have a better standard of living. It's debatable whether that's always the case, because I think one can make the argument that not everybody should go to school. There's great professions in the trades. Right. We have a shortage of skilled labor. So it's an individual decision. It may be more nuanced than what the argument had been over time. But coming back to this general view of, okay, well, how is the debt spent? I would rather have debt spent on things that we've got some agreement within the economics profession, to the extent that's possible. What is it we could do to improve the capital stock or the quality of living or living standards?
Right? Infrastructure.
Infrastructure. But that, the problem with infrastructure, as we've seen, is people could define that many different ways.
You can, but you shouldn't.
Well, that's true. You're right about that. Absolutely.
I mean, infrastructure is not babysitting.
No.
It really isn't. It really is making, you know, the 5G platform what it could be, because just because your phone says 5G doesn't mean it's performing or doing anything at the level that 5G can give us. That,
right.
That is, you know, going from 4G to 5G wasn't like going from 3G to 4G, right? Everything up to 4G was built on data and voice and, you know, really couldn't take the load of the kind of video we're putting out now and smart cities for that matter, smart cars and autonomous driving vehicles. That's infrastructure. And to your point, like, we take on debt for just the most gratuitous, piggish things in the world, which are these stock buybacks, where corporate executives really don't need the money, but they take on the debt because it's low interest, buy back stock, shoot up their options, cash out, they're gone. And they're out of there.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's probably the case in some instances. I don't want to make the CEOs the villains per se. Let's not forget the investor base. The investor base also wants the stock price high. Most of us own stock in one form or another, either outright or in our 401ks or pension plans. So there's also an incentive for the CEOs to generate higher stock returns. And given the cost of capital, in some instances, they believe the buyback thing makes sense. And this is, by the way, through across almost all firms and industries. What troubles me the most, though, when we talk about infrastructure, is every 4 years or every 2 years with midterms and the politics of such, that we wind up changing regulatory and tax policy. And I generally believe in a much more light touch regulation and lower taxes. But we're constantly changing things. And we've used the executive order to change things in a big way. And what that does, Dan, is it just makes it much harder for companies to plan for the future when it could change.
Yeah, it's not sticky at all. It can be just canceled next term.
The buyback is part of it, right? Because it's an easy thing to do. The Fed has encouraged it. because they think, oh, it's just about the cost of money. Money is cheap, then therefore people will use it productively to grow their business. Well, that's not always proven to be the case. I think there's probably more agreement on both sides of the aisle on what the tax structure is supposed to be. But unfortunately, the rhetoric gets in the way, and then whoever's in office tries to undo what was just done. And you can't have long-term planning if the tax and regulatory structure is perpetually changing. It's very inefficient. And I don't know how to fix it. It's very inefficient.
It is inefficient. But I, you know, and you may not want to make the CEOs the villains, but I mean, the part plays out the way the part plays out. And not all CEOs are bad, not all are villains, but like, you know, just mainstream CEOs are now, I mean, I remember in the 80s when CEOs were making $1 million or 10 times or, you know, 50 times, whatever the average employee, they're taking hundreds of millions of dollars a year out. And yes, I as a shareholder want the stock price to be up. I want it to be higher. I just don't want it to be artificially inflated at the cost of the future of the company when it comes time to pay the bill. If you can't grow your business organically in any way, then it's artificially inflated. And I think we're seeing a lot more and more of that. But, you know, who knows? I've been predicting a credit bubble since 2014.
How's that work for you? I'm kidding.
I mean, it's not worked well on a macro level, but it does work well when in my business model where I go after one company at a time.
Right.
You know, I hyper-focus, but yeah, if you've been shorting on a macro level, you've just been getting run over.
But, you know, the thing is, let's come back to the Fed, because I think, you know, sort of maybe original sin was Alan Greenspan when he saved the stock market and developed into the Greenspan put, which became the Bernanke put, the Yellen put, Powell put, et cetera. But it seems to me that people respond to incentives. And the Fed has been a real big disincentive for some time in terms of just keeping rates too low and not letting the credit allocation mechanism work as smoothly as it would based off of price.
Agreed.
And that maybe gets to your point of why you think there's a credit bubble. But what I would like is, unfortunately, the genie's out of the bag, but I think the Fed does itself a big disservice by trying right now, potentially expanding its mandate, which we can get into. But also, you know, they're transparent, but their forecast, their ability to forecast the future is notoriously bad, even among economist standards, both in terms of where GDP is, inflation, and therefore I think they've really done a real disservice to how a normal functioning system would work with incentives where if you lose money, you lose money, and the Fed shouldn't be there to support it. But because they've used asset prices as the primary conduit of policy through quantitative easing and pushing people into risk, whether it's in credit as to reach for yield or whether it's in equities, they've set themselves up for financial instability. And what I fear going forward, Dan, is a period where, you know, we're going to get these bouts of financial speculation, fear and greed, excess volatility, and you see the Fed stop, go, where they never really need to go where they should go because markets hemorrhage, throw a conniption, and the Fed then reverses.
Well, of course, you're 100% right. You remember the day where diversification also meant you put money in the bank because you could get interest on a CD over 6 months or a year. And if you're 80 years old, that probably makes sense. But now you're 80 years old and you have to be almost 100% exposed to the market outside of the home that you live in. They've disincentivized having money in the bank, put it all in the market, and the Fed really is so tied to the market. How do you change it? How are they expanding? Maybe you could explain how they're expanding their mandate and how that should change.
Well, I mean, when I worked at the Fed a while ago, you know, it was sort of common knowledge. And I think economists still generally believe that monetary policy is a fairly blunt tool. And back then it was just basically the Fed funds rate. The Fed funds rates, overnight cost of borrowing, and through those changes in those rates and what the Fed signals going forward, it has an impact on the term structure of rates, the cost of borrowing, which then impacts all these other markets. Now we've codified it more specifically where the Fed has what they call forward guidance. They tell you exactly what they want to do going forward. And they've got quantitative easing, their ability to buy assets, in particular, treasuries and mortgages. But as we saw in the crisis, that could expand to include junk bonds and all sorts of other assets, assuming that the Treasury gives the Fed an equity piece so that if the Fed loses money, they're kind of covered. So And that, by the way, means at some point, it's just a matter of time before the Fed ultimately buys equities. So this quantitative easing, this asset purchases, is something they're going to have going forward. So that expands the mandate. Not only expands the mandate, certainly expands the tools. But the Fed generally, having a very blunt instrument of monetary policy, is now targeted with like unemployment to what Powell now calls broad-based and inclusive employment. That's really tricky because if the unemployment rate is 4%, but it's higher for one group and lower for another, does that mean policy then should be set easier? So, you know, you're getting into sort of microeconomic that become very detailed that really are no, those things aren't going to be controlled by where the Fed sets money or what assets they buy. Related to that is climate change. Clearly, everybody has a stake in the environment, yeah. Not for themselves, certainly their children and the people who are going to live a lot longer than they are. But I'm not sure the Fed should be going into climate change. The Fed's job is low and stable inflation, full employment, and relatively low interest rates. That was what Humphrey Hawkins codified about 40 years ago. This mission creep is not going to end well. And by not ending well, it's just the institution is going to continue to be politicized because the Fed can move much faster than Congress can. And they're going to go in areas they're not supposed to. And from an institutional perspective, they're going to lose credibility and ultimately do themselves in. I would argue that the Fed, of all the government institutions, generally has been perceived by most, and I think for good reason, to be fairly credible, fairly apolitical, fairly competent, their forecasts aside. But that might change over time if you start to go down avenues with which they really have no business going down.
Oh, I could make the case it is changing now.
You're right. Yes, it is changing. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Look, I'm not a climate denier, and I believe in going greener in an evolutionary way, not revolutionary way. You can't change overnight. But yeah, I mean, Janet Yellen has gone full on Greenpeace. I've never heard a Treasury Secretary, you know, speak that way in such a politically charged topic and really pushing the Fed that way. And, you know, that really can't help Powell. I mean, Powell just, that poor guy, he's had a rough 6 years or so. He's just getting his butt kicked by every president coming in.
The thing is, Jay Powell is very successful, as you know, in the private equity world. It has certainly appeared by all indications he was interviewing for his job. Yeah, I would have left. You got the V-shaped recovery. Did a great job with his colleagues in March of 2020, working with Secretary Mnuchin. Leave on a high note, but I guess whatever he wants the job. But interesting enough, ready to your point though about the politics and it moving, I'm guessing that was a big factor why Sarah Bloom Raskin was not now rejoining the Fed, because she mentioned during the crisis she wouldn't have lent to energy companies, which look. Forget whether your views are about climate change and how you move to a more cleaner energy source. The fact is, in the middle of a crisis, of which, by the way, energy companies issue a lot of debt.
Yeah.
It's a capital-intensive business. That would have been the worst thing because, you don't know who the energy company owes money to. That would have caused a cascading effect, not unlike what took place during Lehman. By the way, in the middle of a crisis, in the middle of a pandemic, that would have been the most absurd thing to do. Deal with the issues of fiscal and legislative later, but in the crisis, you don't differentiate who you're lending to. You don't have that luxury, and that hurt her. And I think there's a primary reason why
it should have hurt her. It was a thoughtless comment for somebody going into a job like that. That should haunt you, especially when your swing vote is Manchin. I mean, I heard he's from West Virginia.
Well, I think they have some coal there, right?
I don't know, and. Yeah, where we are in a crisis, I mean, talking about the crisis we're in, I mean, I don't want to be more coal or oil intensive and LNG intensive, but we are where we are, and we're going where we're going, and this is a problem in Europe. Europe's already paying 6 times what we are for...
10 times.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry, 10 times for LNG, and now the breadbasket of Europe is being invaded, and part of what they really provide is fertilizer as well, which takes a lot of energy.
Well, one of the biggest exporters of fertilizer is Russia. So imagine why
they want energy prices high. Yeah,
that's right. And let me just say, every recession since 73 is energy has been a part of either energy We were in recession when energy prices rose, or energy prices rose and tipped us into recession, either directly or indirectly. But what we have going on now, Dan, which just worries me, is we've also got food prices rising sharply alongside energy.
Yeah.
We know shelter costs are going up. You talked about home prices. That's pushing rents up. So when you take food, you take shelter and energy, those are essentials. Those aren't discretionary items, essentials. That covers over 50% of household budget. They don't have a lot left over to spend elsewhere. So the food price rise is something that I'm watching very closely and really troubles me, because people have to eat. They've got to either heat or cool their homes. They have to get to their job. Even if they're working from home, they've got to still get in a car in most cases. And they're really getting squeezed. It's a really tough situation for people, and it's terrible.
I have not in my adult life paid attention to the price of food at the grocery store. And I wonder about this consumer price index and what they're actually measuring. Not everything that I'm seeing, because you've been out there. There are some places where meat has gone up, you know, 50, 60.
100%.
To 100%, yeah.
Yeah.
And you said you don't see it. Is it just because you don't do the shopping, or are you noticing it now?
Not to put too fine a point on it, but I have some money, and I don't normally, you know, I've never really paid attention to it, right? That they've not gone up so quickly that I would notice. I mean, my wife might know what the cost of milk was, or the cost of a filet mignon or something was, but I really kind of didn't. And over this last year, I'm like, holy cow, these cows are expensive.
It's a super cow.
And I was going to say, man, you sound a little bit like Stephen Colbert there. I'll just buy a Tesla if my gas price drops. And I don't mind an extra dollar for me. I mean, it doesn't matter for me. I was going to say, Carl should be, you hedged yourself at the end, Danny. You're going to give Carl a raise.
Yeah.
Well, listen, if I start paying Carl, that would be an improvement for Carl. Carl needs to pay me.
I'm going to give you guys a great statistic. I've gotten a lot of use out of this over the years. Energy, you know, all these products all tend to move together. They're all correlated, which I know you know what that means. But for the listeners, sure. Basically the prices all trend together. So a real simple rule of thumb, it's worked great over the past few decades. It hasn't loosened its correlation at all, is for every one penny increase in gasoline, household energy consumption goes up $1 billion. So that means that the increase in gas. So like basically, okay, retail gas prices in January were about 3.25 nationally. Now they're up to a little over $4.30. Over a full year period, that's over $100 billion tax hike on consumers. So if you're not feeling it, you may only be feeling it now, or you're seeing it in food, just the gas price alone is going to suck a lot of disposable income, liquidity, out of the economy, especially for the middle and lower income worker. Remember, median family wages are only around 70,000, give or take a little. So, you know, for most people who live paycheck to paycheck, paying an extra 25, 50 cents a gallon for gas, that's a big deal.
How about paying an extra $2? I mean, there's another one that I actually started to notice too, the price of gas.
Yeah.
Everybody had always complained about that. This is a wrong time to have an Escalade, by the way. The extended version was a bad idea. You know, it's $7 some places. I don't know how that can really affect you.
Yeah, no, and to be continue with the bearer of bad news, the summer driving season actually is a bit of a misnomer in the sense that seasonally gasoline prices peak right around Memorial Day. So to the extent that we've already seen a near doubling in oil prices from late last year, gas is already rising. It's likely we're going to see gas at least rise into May. So this hit to purchasing power is going to intensify, overlaid again, Dan, with what's happening on the food side of things. And I mean, that's why I would have done things differently. Look, this White House isn't calling me, asking me my opinion. I would have advised them differently.
They should.
Well, they could. I would take the call, but I think there are things we could do. Your point about transitioning to cleaner fuel makes a lot of sense. But, you know, one of the things that is incredibly inexpensive and incredibly reliable is clean energy, or clean nuclear energy.
Yeah.
And yet the Germans recently, they may be changing, decide they're going to close their 3 nuclear plants, maybe because there was fear was what happened with Fukushima in 2011. And then there's one nuclear plant, I believe in California, that's being closed. I mean, we should almost be doing the exact opposite, because you need, solar and wind, as you know, has yet to be.
It's just not efficient. Yeah, it's not efficient. And yeah. And Fukushima, maybe you shouldn't put a reactor on, you know, on the coastline.
Right.
You know, in tsunami territory. Last I heard, Germany doesn't have a lot of coastline, but they have a lot of dependence on Russian gas.
That's right.
Going electric, have you seen what a lithium mine looks like and the effect it has on the environment?
Yeah. Well, I always wonder, you know, I remember years ago, I think it was Larry King, I was watching, and there was fear. Remember the cell phones would cause brain cancer?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that's the case. But, you know, what about sitting on a battery for a couple hundred thousand miles?
Yeah. I can just see the headline now, Larry King back from the grave to tell you that your prostate's going to be the size of a grapefruit. Again.
But, you know, coming back to what Carl was saying, though, you know, I wonder, you know, and I'm just asking, this isn't like, because I think the EV vehicles are, I mean, it's the wave of the future. You know, what do you do with the batteries how do you get rid of batteries?
You send them to China. And then China says they'll take them and they'll put them in a safe place and they dump them in the ocean on the way.
Yeah.
I mean, tell me that's not the current modus operandi with trash or the computer chip mercury that we send to China.
Yeah.
They say they take it, they dump it in the ocean.
Could be the case. Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, this is the thing. This comes back to this whole issue of free trade and fair trade. And there's no question, you know, the U.S. doesn't do everything right. We do a lot of things wrong. But to the best of our abilities, we do have environmental standards. We have work safety standards. We don't have children, to our knowledge, at least legally, working in factories underage. Not all places in the world adhere to those sort of basic standards. So
no.
It wouldn't surprise me some places are doing what they're not supposed to. But I don't know what the answer is, Dan. But look, the thing is that this inflation we've got is going to persist a bit longer. The economy is softening. Good policy could obviate some of these stresses. My fear is it's just not going to happen.
What are the chances you see any kind of period where we've gone too far and we get into deflationary cycles or stagflation?
So right now, I'd say we're in stagflation with a little S. You know, it's not a big S. I mean, inflation's very high. It's the highest in 40 years. But the market's saying inflation expectations are going to come down. Again, that maybe it's not transitory, but it's not going to persist. So I'd say stagflation right now with a little S. If there is a credit bubble, if there is an equity bubble, to borrow one of your phrases, and those markets were to burst, what we do know across countries is that asset price collapses are always and everywhere deflationary. So it is not inconceivable. Worst case, you'd have an inflationary boom and then an inflationary bust that ultimately leads to a deflationary bust. I mean, that'd be the worst of all scenarios. I'm not that pessimistic. I don't think that'll happen. But it very well, 3 years from now, 4 years from now, with wrong policies, yes, we could have a lot lower inflation, a lot lower price level, because we found that, you know, we did a lot of things to inflate assets way above and beyond where fundamental value attributes those prices should be.
Yeah, and you don't really seem to be, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but like, you know, I don't know, I'm an alarmist about $30 trillion in debt, because I remember when we were at zero in near 2000. No, it's not a big problem for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, there's two issues you talk about. Debt, the $30 trillion you mentioned, and the unfunded liabilities, which I'm going to guess is something like double. It's like 60. I wouldn't worry about the 60 so much, because unfortunately, by the time we have to pay that, we're either going to means test it, we're going to tax the people, or we're not going to give it to everybody who, you know, for means testing is supposed to get it. So I'm not worried about the unfunded liabilities as much. What my guess is will happen eventually. Someone's going to be creative and say, okay, well, the Federal Reserve owns $10 trillion of treasuries. It's about nine, but let's say we keep the number simple, 10. It's just one branch of the government owing the other branch. Let's just get rid of the one third of the debt. Voila, we've just gotten rid of it. I wouldn't be surprised if that becomes a political idea or a policy idea at some point down the line.
And you don't think that that would have a negative effect on other countries' trust and faith in our credit markets?
Oh, it would. No, it would. But I mean, right now, but I mean, no, definitely it would. And, you know, what we're seeing now is it would hurt the dollar, no question. But right now, what we're doing may also hurt the dollar long term. I mean, you're seeing China and seeing the Saudis reach out to the Chinese about paying dollars.
Yeah, the petro yuan.
I mean, very seldom do you ever have these immediate secular shifts where you see something go, oh, my God, this could really change.
Right.
That's one to keep an eye on. So,
yeah.
anyway, I don't want to get into the politics of it because it's beyond, I think, the scope of this discussion, and I'll probably upset half your listeners.
Well, you're supposed to upset half the listeners. We're not doing our job if we don't upset half the listeners. I mean, like, nobody's listening to this show to feel good. Go listen to another show.
So is William Devane right then? Should we be putting all our money in gold and silver or crypto?
Oh, you know, how great are those commercials?
He's got his World War II bomber jacket on. He's like, I buy gold.
The only one I like better is the one they've got. I actually know a couple of people in it, but I like the one they've got, like, the four people that do their testimony. Yeah, yeah. Rich Dad, Poor Dad, yeah. Robert, what's his name?
Iaki or something?
Yeah. Yeah. I
love silver.
This isn't investment advice, but good luck.
Yeah, no, I prefer Tom Selleck pitching reverse mortgages to old people.
How could that go wrong?
How could a reverse mortgage in your 70s go wrong? I don't know. You know, the only money you have for the short years you have left is gone. I mean, what about crypto? I mean, where do you guys land on this? Because this became a bit of a hot topic for you while you were there. I mean, you had to be talking about it quite a bit.
Yes. I mean, the crypto, so to me, crypto, I feel it's very binary. Like, it's either going to be this great, phenomenal tool. And, you know, I've listened to people like Michael Saylor talk about it. And if you know who he is, I'm guessing you do. But then also I see the fact that the Fed is taking liquidity out of the system. There's inflation. The cryptocurrencies are supposed to perform well in this sort of environment, and they're not, though it's rallied the last few days. So I'm not really sure. I think for those that view it as it is a tremendous speculative, I underscore speculative with a capital S, asset, that for those that aren't fey of heart, just have to be very careful. I don't want to tell people to buy anything, but my point is it may very well have a place. It may allocate a sleeve of investable assets. I don't know the answer to it. So I think you have to approach it where, again, it's binary. I can either make a lot of money on it, it's going to be worth an infinitesimally high amount, or it could virtually be worth zero. And that's where I would leave it. But I don't know. Another thing is, Dan, I don't know what happened on the regulatory side. I mean, the Biden administration recently put out, I guess it was a white paper that certainly was much less hostile to crypto. People thought it would be much worse. Gary Gensler, the SEC, wants to regulate it as a security. I mean, so it kind of depends what happens out of Washington. But right now, it looks like the news is better. So we'll see. But I don't know where it goes. I own a little bit of crypto for what it's.
Yeah, everybody should, as little as you can afford, and an emphasis on little.
Or as much as you can afford to lose.
Yeah, right. But, you know, you saw China come out with, and this is so ironic because they make all the machines for mining now, but they come out with their own digital currency and they ban crypto. And now we're coming out with our own digital currency. But at the same time, it's like you said, they weren't necessarily hostile towards crypto. Doesn't it kind of become a competitor, though?
It does. But again, the thing is, you're using crypto because you want to have basically independence from central authority. Yeah. But, you know, you look at what happened in Canada with the GoFundMe. Oof. And the fact that people are worried about, you know, government control and lack of freedom. Crypto is supposed to give you that freedom. But a digital currency actually would go in the other direction. I mean, you could tell a very Orwellian story of how, for better or for worse, if people do things the state doesn't like, to be able to confiscate their financial assets. And maybe in some cases that could be, that's a legitimate argument, you know, money laundering, drug dealing, et cetera. But, you know, you need due process. We have a nation of laws. And I do think when I hear about digitalization of currency, you know, part of me gets worried that it's not the freedom you think it might be, which is also another reason why, Dan, we're probably never going to get rid of cash, because cash has that,
cash is cash.
Cash has that anonymity that you don't get arguably from a digital currency, where people know what you're spending money on and they could control it. They could seize your bank account.
Yeah. There's a long tail for that.
The long tail. Absolutely right.
Yeah. You know, there is an upcoming generation that are very cashless in nature and in their thinking. I'm never going to get there.
Well, the World Economic Forum will tell you should be happy. You own nothing. You should be thrilled. Right. That was that commercial they pulled. Remember?
Yeah.
The great.
Yeah. I don't know how wrong they are.
I mean, that's just the height of self-unawareness. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, where does it go from here? I mean, what do we think about our process with China and the competition that we're in with them. I kind of feel like we're well behind at the moment in a lot of different areas, except for maybe semiconductors, which they're catching up on, not the least of which if they take Taiwan, they've caught up. Where do you see it?
Yeah. So look, the one thing is I would say that where there is some, maybe the most similar, although my former colleagues may disagree, but I would say the most similarity between Biden and Trump is probably on the policies as it relates to China.
Yeah.
Where basically they're a peer competitor, and that hasn't changed. And the administration, the current administration has not removed many, if any, of the tariffs. I think that was probably a positive, although there might be some talk of removing a few. So I think there's probably, if there's any similarity in policy that the Biden folks have, I think have generally kept most, at least to this point, what I've seen, most of the Trump policies in place, although they may not persist. So China remains an adversary in that regard, or a peer competitor, I think is a better way to put it. Taiwan is certainly something to be mindful of. Without going into the situation with Russia, Ukraine, the Chinese have always said Taiwan's part of their country. So it's a bit different.
It is.
And one has to wonder what happens there. It's certainly the potential for another geopolitical flashpoint. And it's my understanding that Taiwan, on the high value added chain of semiconductors, Taiwan produces the vast majority of those products. I think what it means, Dan, is something that the Trump administration had been encouraging, and I'd like to see going forward, and that is re-onshoring, resourcing more production on U.S. shores. But then to do that, though, Dan, you need cheap and reliable energy. You need low and attractive taxes. You basically need a pro-business, pro-regulatory backdrop to attract that capital, to build the facilities and plants, to raise those marginal wage rates, because economics is useful in that the marginal wage earner sets the price. There's a lot of high paying jobs in manufacturing. So if we could bring some of that high value added production back to the US, I know Intel has talked about building factories, to name one, others, that's all great news.
Yeah. Samsung and Intel.
Yeah.
Everybody's building a factory in Texas right now, Joe.
But, you know, you mentioned that, but why? They have no state income tax.
Right.
They've got a very good education system.
Right.
They've got excellent rules with regard to, like, medical malpractice. It's an attractive place to do business.
Right.
I mean, we are not doing the things that we need to do to make it the Texas experiment, because they do a lot. I don't do everything right. But from a business side, they've done some wonderful things. And we should use that as a case study of what we need to do. I mean, I'm a New Yorker. But unlike California, I don't think their economic policies are very good, but at least they've got nice climate. In New York, you're freezing your tuchus off.
The only thing good about New York's economic policy is that it's slightly better than California, which is just unlivable economically for whatever the climate is. And on top of what you're talking about for onshoring, you know, just understand that we are also woefully behind in rare earths. Not that we don't have them. We do. Everybody does. But, you know, they're very poisonous to mine, and they're very difficult to mine. And we got, yeah, there's that pro-business environment with our EPA, which is a good thing, not a bad thing.
I would say, you know, the NEPA laws, we try to update those. National Environmental Protection Act, the Policy Act, NEPA. 1972 or 73 law. One of my colleagues I'm thinking of is going to, he'll get mad when he hears this, because I've heard him talk about it so much. I should know all this by heart. But like just the permitting process,
yeah,
the ability to basically get stuff done. You talk about infrastructure. When the average project, Dan, takes 7 years, we got to do a much better job cost benefit analysis. I mean, these things should not take this long. I mean, New York State is still debating the efficacy of shale oil and gas drilling. I mean, at some point, you either do it or you don't, but like we need to really modernize the permitting process, because we're hurting ourselves. And we don't want to pollute and cause extra negative externalities on the environment. But at the same time, we've got a very antiquated system of rules, and we're unable to change it because we're competing with other people who have oftentimes a flagrant disregard for any of these things.
China.
But ultimately, we're going to hurt ourselves, because energy is fungible. So, you know, do you want cleaner energy coming from the U.S. or do you want dirtier energy coming from someplace else?
Russia.
You know, until we can figure out to use hydrogen more broadly, or nuclear, or something really clean, like I'm all for the U.S. doing more of it. Let's get our energy independence back. And it's not there now.
It's really not even I don't want to oversimplify it, but it is kind of flipping a switch for us to have energy independence. I mean,
it is
very close to it.
It is, but just two things I want to tell you. Energy is a very capital intensive business, and these companies are afraid to make an investment if they think
Agreed.
They're going to be vilified again in 6 months.
Yeah.
And also, too, it's interesting, and I just learned this, you know, these wells, you know, once they're not operational, these wells always don't operate at the same efficiency when they're reopened. So you could start tomorrow, but in terms of actually getting the product out of the ground, could be a little bit longer.
Yeah. And I totally agree with you. And it goes back to your earlier point that executive orders are not the way to deal with something like this. It's the way it was dealt with, you know, the last three or four administrations, and it's start, stop. And there's no real cohesive plan to say, here's the energy we're going to use for the next 5 or 10 years. And with this, we're going to grow the green sector through tax incentives and what dirty energy, let's say. There's no plan there. And it's the inaction and inertia that cause others to get well ahead of us.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we're not painting a very rosy picture, I don't think. I mean, I think we're going to be okay in the end. I don't know why, but I think we're going to be okay.
I mean, good policy leads to good results. I mean, just sometimes it's like, you know, it goes with Churchill about democracy, you know, works best after everything else was tried. It's a horrible paraphrase, but, you know, we're just going to do all the wrong things before we come back to realizing what the good things are that work. But there's going to, of course, create a lot of unnecessary harm and damage in the process with a lot of suffering, because I see when you have high inflation like this, it really damages people's living standards and confidence in institutions and in the broad system. And I hope it gets better sooner. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, I mean, democracy is at best a horrible form of government. It just happens to be the best humankind has ever come up with. So, you know, what are you going to do? Nobody's come up with anything better, as far as I'm concerned. But we do need to move fast. We do need to move to energy independence. You and I agree on that. Inflation, I think, continues to be a concern. And yeah, I think the one thing that's not being talked about that you really discussed here, and I appreciate, is how the Fed is expanding its mandate and the mission creep. It's beyond mission creep at some points. And I totally see them coming in and just buying equities at some point for the next piece in their toolkit.
Well, Yellen said that actually back in 20, it was either late 19 or I think it was late 19. She mentioned at some point the Fed, it may have been early 20. I don't recall exactly, but she had mentioned that, look, at some point that this will be feasible. And we've already, look, Pandora is out of the box. And this is the next route we're going to go down. Because again, the pain of an asset deflation also is very difficult for people. So we're kind of stuck between, you know, the inflationary boom bust and what ultimately could be a deflationary boom bust. I think you mentioned earlier housing. Housing is in good shape. I mean, that's the one asset. We haven't had over leverage. We haven't had excess lending.
Inventory is manageable or low?
Yeah, very manageable. Very manageable. Very low inventories across most of the country. So that's a positive. But look, we've been through worse in the United States. We have a rich history, and we've had worse situations in the 1970s. Certainly you go back when we've had, you know, 1800s, of course. But again, I wish we had some ability to be less emotive and more thoughtful in our approach, did a little bit less feeling and just sort of did more cold calculus of cost benefits of everything. And what that would mean, Dan, is just whatever your views are, it's just not all bad, all good. It's life to me a little bit more complex than that.
Or I hate people who have a different view.
Yeah.
Or I hate people of a different, exactly. If I hate people of a different view, that's exactly right. And I mean, I appreciate this podcast and people getting out doing these to try to get information. I feel too often the narrative is too consistent across traditional media. And it's important people want information to seek it out. I think I was sort of general in my comments. I'm trying not to alienate one side or the other. But this at least is a step in that direction. So I appreciate you having me, and I thank you for the discussion. I would strongly advocate you give Carl something, maybe like at Applebee's.
I tell you what.
There are some labor laws, you know.
listen, You're going to come here and work with him for a day, and then we'll talk about it. And we'll see. But, you know, in the meantime,
fair enough.
If you still have contacts in the government, when they start buying equities directly, I have come up with a SPAC called Wolf SPAC, and and I think it's going to be very Chamath worthy. So it'll be good stuff.
Think about Wolf. I can tell you something very funny. So I have an 8-year-old, and my son, I read him the Three Little Pigs.
Yeah.
But it was from the wolf's perspective.
Oh.
Yeah. Everybody's got a perspective.
Everybody's got a perspective. So.
I'm not sure that makes you father of the year. But a wolf's got to eat for an 8-year-old, but I like it. It's good stuff. It's great having you on. It's a great place to end. Teach all your 8-year-olds that wolves need to eat. Joe, where can people follow you? Do you have Twitter? You have a blog? You have a show you do?
Thank you. I'm very ambivalent about this stuff, but thank you for asking. The best place I would say, Dan, is at Lavornianomics.
Okay, that makes sense. Which, I see the play on words he did there.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah, I can't say, you know, this is sort of, I mean, but technically, I guess, been on Twitter for a while, so it was a little bit more creative whenever it was I first got on. I feel like Twitter is just, you could just blow yourself up so quickly and easily with these things.
Oh, it's Thunderdome. It really is. It's a terrible place to be, but it's where we are, and it's what you need. I mean, it's what, you know, I need for my business to push out reports and look for people to get that differentiated point of view that Joe was talking about. It's not mainstream media. It's not necessarily Joe out there pushing a left or a right narrative, but what he believes as an economist, I encourage you to follow that. We'll make sure and tag that in our show notes. And last word, Joe.
Now I can leave.
Yeah. You know what?
Efficient like an economist, right?
I am actually going to put that on my gravestone.
Now I'm going.
So good. Joe, thank you very much. You've been a great guest. And for those of you listening, I appreciate you listening. If you like the show, retweet it. If you don't like the show, I don't really care. It's time to leave.
Awesome.